Chapter 108. Domestic Relations. It was not in the nature of things that a man of Mr. Dombey's mood, opposed to such a spirit as he had raised against himself, should be softened in the imperious asperity of his temper, or that the cold hard armor of pride in which he lived encased, should be made more flexible by constant collision with haughty scorn and defiance. It is the curse of such a nature, it is a main part of the heavy retribution on itself it bears within itself, that, while deference and concession swell its evil qualities, and are the food it grows upon, resistance and a questioning of its exacting claims foster it too, no less. The evil that is in it finds equally its means of growth and propagation in opposites. It draws support and life from sweets and bitters. Bowed down before, or unacknowledged, it still enslaves the breast in which it has its throne, and, worshipped or rejected, is as hard a master as the devil in dark fables. Towards his first wife, Mr. Dombey, in his cold and lofty arrogance, had borne himself like the removed being he almost conceived himself to be. He had been Mr. Dombey with her when she first saw him, and he was Mr. Dombey when she died. He had asserted his greatness during their whole married life, and she had meekly recognized it. He had kept his distant seat of state on the top of his throne, and she her humble station on its lowest step, and much good it had done him, so to live in solitary bondage to his one idea. He had imagined that the proud character of his second wife would have been added to his own, would have merged into it, and exalted his greatness. He had pictured himself haughtier than ever, with Edith's haughtiness subservient to his. He had never entertained the possibility of its arraying itself against him. And now, when he found it rising in his path at every step and turn of his daily life, fixing its cold, defiant, and contemptuous face upon him, this pride of his, instead of withering, or hanging down its head beneath the shock, put forth new shoots, became more concentrated and intense, more gloomy, sullen, irksome, and unyielding than it had ever been before. Who wears such armor too, bears with him ever another heavy retribution. It is of proof against conciliation, love, and confidence, against all gentle sympathy from without, all trust, all tenderness, all soft emotion, but to deep stabs in the self-love. It is as vulnerable as the bare breast to steel, and such tormenting festers rankle there, as follow on no other wounds, no, though dealt with the mailed hand of pride itself, on weaker pride, disarmed and thrown down. Such wounds were his. He felt them sharply, in the solitude of his old rooms, whither he now began often to retire again, and pass long solitary hours. It seemed his fate, to be ever proud and powerful, ever humbled and powerless, where he would be most strong. Who seemed fated to work out that doom? Who? Who was it who could win his wife as she had won his boy? Who was it who had shown him that new victory, as he sat in the dark corner? Who was it whose least word did, what his utmost means could not? Who was it who, unaided by his love, regard or notice, thrived and grew beautiful, when those so aided died? Who could it be, but the same child at whom he had often glanced uneasily in her motherless infancy, with a kind of dread, lest he might come to hate her, and of whom his foreboding was fulfilled, for he did hate her in his heart. Yes, and he would have it hatred, and he made it hatred, though some sparkles of the light in which she had appeared before him on the memorable night of his return home with his bride, occasionally hung about her still. He knew now that she was beautiful. He did not dispute that she was graceful and winning, and that in the bright dawn of her womanhood she had come upon him, a surprise. But he turned even this against her. In his sullen and unwholesome brooding, the unhappy man, with a dull perception of his alienation from all hearts, and a vague yearning for what he had all his life repelled, made a distorted picture of his rights and wrongs, and justified himself with it against her. The worthier she promised to be of him, the greater claim he was disposed to antedate upon her duty and submission. When had she ever shown him duty and submission? Did she grace his life for Edith's? had her attractions been manifested first to Amaretheth? Why, he and she had never been, from her birth, like father and child. They had always been estranged. She had crossed him every way and everywhere. She was leagued against him now. Her very beauty softened natures that were obdurate to him, and insulted him with an unnatural triumph. It may have been that in all this there were mutterings of an awakened feeling in his breast, however selfishly aroused by his position of disadvantage, in comparison with what she might have made his life. But he silenced the distant thunder with the rolling of his sea of pride. He would bear nothing but his pride. And in his pride, a heap of inconsistency, and misery, and self-inflicted torment, he hated her. To the moody, stubborn, sullen demon that possessed him, his wife opposed her different pride in its full force. They never could have led a happy life together, but nothing could have made it more unhappy than the willful and determined warfare of such elements. His pride was set upon maintaining his magnificent supremacy, and forcing recognition of it from her. She would have been racked to death, and turned but her haughty glance of calm and flexible disdain upon him, to the last. Such recognition from Edith. He little knew through what a storm and struggle she had been driven onward to the crowning honor of his hand. He little knew how much she thought she had conceded, when she suffered him to call her wife. Mr. Dombey was resolved to show her that he was supreme. There must be no will but his. Proud he desired that she should be, but she must be proud for, not against him. As he sat alone, hardening, he would often hear her go out and come home, treading the round of London life with no more heed of his liking or disliking, pleasure or displeasure, than if he had been her groom. Her cold supreme indifference, his own unquestioned attribute usurped, stung him more than any other kind of treatment could have done, and he determined to bend her to his magnificent and stately will. He had been long communing with these thoughts, when one night he sought her in her own apartment, after he had heard her return home late. She was alone, in her brilliant dress, and had but that moment come from her mother's room. Her face was melancholy and pensive when he came upon her, but it marked him at the door, for, glancing at the mirror before it, he saw immediately, as in a picture frame, the knitted brow and darkened beauty that he knew so well. "Mrs. Dombey," apostrophe he said, entering, "I must beg leave to have a few words with you." "Apostrophe, tomorrow, apostrophe," she replied. "There is no time like the present, madam," apostrophe he returned. "You mistake your position. I am used to choose my own times, not two of them chosen for me. I think you scarcely understand who and what I am, Mrs. Dombey." "I think," apostrophe she answered, "that I understand you very well." Apostrophe, she looked upon him as she said so, and folding her white arms, sparkling with gold and gems, upon her swelling breast, turned away her eyes. If she had been less handsome, and less stately in her cold composure, she might not have had the power of impressing him with the sense of disadvantage that penetrated through his utmost pride. But she had the power, and he felt it keenly. He glanced round the room, saw how the splendid means of personal adornment, and the luxuries of dress, were scattered here and there, and disregarded. Not in mere caprice and carelessness, or so he thought, but in a steadfast, haughty disregard of costly things, and felt it more and more. Chaplets of flowers, plumes of feathers, jewels, laces, silks and satins, look where he would, he saw riches, despised, poured out, and made of no account. The very diamonds, a marriage gift, that rose and fell impatiently upon her bosom, seemed to pant to break the chain that clasped them round her neck, and roll down on the floor, where she might tread upon them. He felt his disadvantage, and he showed it. Solemn and strange among this wealth of color and voluptuous glitter, strange and constrained towards its haughty mistress, whose repellent beauty it repeated, and presented all around him, as in so many fragments of a mirror, he was conscious of embarrassment and awkwardness. Nothing that ministered to her disdainful self-possession could fail to gall him. Galled and irritated with himself, he sat down, and went on, in no improved humor. Mrs. Dombey, it is very necessary that there should be some understanding arrived at between us. Your conduct does not please me, madam. Apostrophe, she merely glanced at him again, and again averted her eyes. But she might have spoken for an hour, and expressed less. I repeat, Mrs. Dombey, does not please me. I have already taken occasion to request that it may be corrected. I now insist upon it. Apostrophe, you chose a fitting occasion for your first remonstrance, sir, and you adopt a fitting manner and a fitting word for your second. You insist. To me. Apostrophe, madam, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, with his most offensive air of state, I have made you my wife. You bear my name. You are associated with my position and my reputation. I will not say that the world in general may be disposed to think you honored by that association, but I will say that I am accustomed to insist to my connections and dependents. Apostrophe, which may you be pleased to consider me, she asked. Possibly I may think that my wife should partake or does partake, and cannot help herself of both characters, Mrs. Dombey. Apostrophe, she bent her eyes upon him steadily, and set her trembling lips. He saw her bosom throb, and saw her face flush and turn white. All this he could know, and did. But he could not know that one word was whispering in the deep recesses of her heart, to keep her quiet, and that the word was Florence. Blind idiot, rushing to a precipice. He thought she stood in awe of him. You are too expensive, madam, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey. You are extravagant. You waste a great deal of money, or what would be a great deal in the pockets of most gentlemen, in cultivating a kind of society that is useless to me, and, indeed, that upon the whole, is disagreeable to me. I have to insist upon a total change in all these respects. I know that in the novelty of possessing a tithe of such means as fortune has placed at your disposal, ladies are apt to run into a sudden extreme. There has been more than enough of that extreme. I beg that Mrs. Granger's very different experiences may now come to the instruction of Mrs. Dombey. Apostrophe, still the fixed look, the trembling lips, the throbbing breast, the face now crimson and now white, and still the deep whisper, Florence, Florence, speaking to her in the beating of her heart. His insolence of self-importance dilated as he saw this alteration in her. Swollen no less by her past scorn of him, and his so recent feeling of disadvantage, than by her present submission, as he took it to be, it became too mighty for his breast, and burst all bounds. Why, who could long resist his lofty will and pleasure? He had resolved to conquer her, and look here. You will further please, madam, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, in a tone of sovereign command, to understand distinctly that I am to be deferred to and obeyed, that I must have a positive show and confession of deference before the world, madam. I am used to this. I require it as my right. In short, I will have it. I consider it no unreasonable return for the worldly advancement that has befallen you, and I believe nobody will be surprised, either at its being required from you, or at your making it. To me. Apostrophe, he added, with emphasis. No word from her. No change in her. Her eyes upon him. I have learned from your mother, Mrs. Dombey, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, with magisterial importance, what no doubt you know, namely, that Brighton is recommended for her health. Mr. Carker has been so good, she changed suddenly. Her face and bosom glowed, as if the red light of an angry sunset had been flung upon them. Not unobservant of the change, and putting his own interpretation upon it, Mr. Dombey resumed. Mr. Carker has been so good as to go down and secure a house there, for a time. On the return of the establishment to London, I shall take such steps for its better management as I consider necessary. One of these will be the engagement at Brighton, if it is to be effected, of a very respectable reduced person there, a Mrs. Pipchin, formerly employed in a situation of trust in my family, to act as housekeeper. An establishment like this, presided over but nominally, Mrs. Dombey, requires a competent head. Apostrophe, she had changed her attitude before he arrived at these words, and now sat still looking at him fixedly, turning a bracelet round and round upon her arm, not winding it about with a light, womanly touch, but pressing and dragging it over the smooth skin, until the white limb showed a bar of red. I observed, apostrophe said Mr. Dombey, and this concludes what I deem it necessary to say to you at present, Mrs. Dombey, I observed a moment ago, madam, that my allusion to Mr. Carker was received in a peculiar manner. On the occasion of my happening to point out to you, before that confidential agent, the objection I had to your mode of receiving my visitors, you were pleased to object to his presence. You will have to get the better of that objection, madam, and to accustom yourself to it very probably on many similar occasions, unless you adopt the remedy which is in your own hands, of giving me no cause of complaint. Mr. Carker, apostrophe said Mr. Dombey, who, after the emotion he had just seen, set great store by this means of reducing his proud wife, and who was perhaps sufficiently willing to exhibit his power to that gentleman in a new and triumphant aspect, Mr. Carker being in my confidence, Mrs. Dombey, may very well be in yours to such an extent. I hope, Mrs. Dombey, apostrophe he continued, after a few moments, during which, in his increasing haughtiness, he had improved on his idea, I may not find it necessary ever to entrust Mr. Carker with any message of objection or remonstrance to you, but as it would be derogatory to my position and reputation to be frequently holding trivial disputes with a lady upon whom I have conferred the highest distinction that it is in my power to bestow, I shall not scruple to avail myself of his services, if I see occasion. Apostrophe, and now, apostrophe he thought, rising in his moral magnificence, and rising a stiffer and more impenetrable man than ever, she knows me and my resolution. Apostrophe, the hand that had so pressed the bracelet was laid heavily upon her breast, but she looked at him still, with an unaltered face, and said in a low voice, wait, for God's sake, I must speak to you. Apostrophe, why did she not, and what was the inward struggle that rendered her incapable of doing so, for minutes, while, in the strong constraint she put upon her face, it was as fixed as any statue's looking upon him with neither yielding nor unyielding, liking nor hatred, pride not humility. Nothing but a searching gaze? Did I ever tempt you to seek my hand? Did I ever use any art to win you? Was I ever more conciliating to you when you pursued me, than I have been since our marriage? Was I ever other to you than I am? Apostrophe, it is wholly unnecessary, madam, apostrophe said Mr. Dombey, to enter upon such discussions. Apostrophe, did you think I loved you? Did you know I did not? Did you ever care, man, for my heart, or propose to yourself to win the worthless thing? Was there any poor pretense of any in our bargain? Upon your Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.